AI simply needs open access content to thrive into the future.
Welcome to the Trends in Academic Publishing podcast with me, Patrick Schaeff. My guest this week is a pioneer of open access. She was head of content and global outreach at Knowledge Unlatched, a crowdfunding model that allowed libraries to support open access scholarly books and journals. Her name is Dr. Mirella Roncevic.
Roncevic, that's the English version. That's not to say that you wouldn't be able to pronounce it, but people know me by that.
The Americanized pronunciation is a concession to a career spent mainly in New York. But Mirella is originally from Croatia, and that's where she's recently been doing some deep thinking about open access in the era of AI. And I'm delighted she's chosen the Trends in Academic Publishing podcast to explain her fascinating new insights publicly for the first time. Mirella, welcome. Delighted to have you join us today. Thank you for your time. When I wanted to think about having you on this podcast, you and I spoke, I was sort of very impressed with your storied career that you had across publishing, most recently as head of content with Knowledge Unlatched. And you seem to be somebody who, from quite an early age, has been passionate about books and the academic publishing industry. I've seen a few of your TED Talks and other pieces. I wonder if you could just tell me how you got into publishing.
Well, actually, I studied literature and journalism at NYU. So that was a very natural progression between my bachelor's and master's to get a job in publishing in New York. I thought I was very lucky to be able to be part of that scene, landing of my very first job at Penguin Books in New York. So my career started on the commercial side of publishing and in editorial. And then I moved on from there to become a book review editor at a literary magazine, also in New York. And then somewhere along the way, when I was working at that literary magazine / library journal, I began to work more as a journalist covering the digital side of the publishing industry. And I wasn't really happy about that in the beginning because I really wanted to be a book review editor. But someone had to do it, so I took the chance, and it was quite a challenge in the beginning to keep up with all these new companies entering the industry, making all these things possible with digital content, and eventually connecting me with all sorts of players, particularly on the academic side, and getting me excited more and more about this idea of open access and opening books and later journals in ways that protect publishers, but make the world knowledge freely available, legally and freely available to anyone anywhere in the world. So it was around that time that I switched, made the switch and decided to go in the direction of open access publishing in scholarly communications, working with academic publishers and different types of organizations making open access possible.
And why did that get you excited? It doesn't get everybody excited. What was it about it?
Well, I also, while I was working in publishing, I went back to school to get my master's and then my PhD. And because I always wanted to not just write creatively, but also challenge myself as a researcher and academic. And it just made me realize about the importance of having access to the research I needed when I needed it. And because of my having lived on two continents almost simultaneously the past 15 years, having that luxury to live in both New York and then spend my summers in Croatia, I really began to see the discrepancies between what university library such as the library at NYU could offer versus what the researchers here in Zagreb could access, particularly back in the day before Croatia joined the EU. So I saw the discrepancies. I also became increasingly more aware of piracy online, and publishers trying to protect their property, their intellectual property, by having to deal with all kinds of tools that kept popping up that made everybody really nervous and confused. And at the turn of the century, the industry became more and more serious about how do we do this legally? How, because that's really the best way to compete with piracy is to legalize what someone else wants to access illegally. Once it becomes legal, a lot of different obstacles are removed. And all these different business models started to pop up, and it became quite clear to everyone working with open access that there was no one size fits all. There was no one model that answers all the questions, and that there would be a lot of complexity along the way. And I took interest in that. How do we solve the problems? How do we make it so that we can open the world's knowledge by engaging everybody who needs to be part of the story, by taking advantage of library funding, by making sure that publishers are compensated fairly, as well as scholars, and by, you know, fulfilling the number one promise of open access, which is to make research and the world's knowledge freely available to anyone, anywhere, without restriction.
It's funny, I've never heard anybody talk about OA being originating in reaction to piracy. You think that's, I wasn't around at the time in this industry. Is that the reason why it started?
I certainly wouldn't want to speculate why it started by singling out a single reason, but piracy definitely was an important accelerator and motivator for both commercial and academic publishing. And for a while, I followed this as a journalist in New York, and I know that a piracy website such as Sci-Hub was all the rage back in the day. I learned that piracy websites, let's not single out any one of them, but certainly the most popular ones, got the heaviest usage in the most developed countries.
Right.
The heaviest usage in the US, the UK, the places where you would assume that institutions such as Cambridge University, Oxford University, MIT, Harvard, Yale would have the most amazing library resources. But why is it then that these piracy sites used to get so much usage in the campuses of some of the world's most renowned institutions? And the answer was really simple. It's just easy to get to them. They look like a Google search interface. And to this day, that Google interface is hard to beat. My daughter once said, when I asked her many times, like, why don't you use the library? And she would say, I feel like I've left, this was years ago. She would say, I feel like I have left the internet. And I just thought that was such a funny way to phrase it. Because this new generation of researchers or students is not used to the kind of advanced searching and keyword searching that my generation is, and then various others. Gen Z tends to operate from a very different position. They expect the internet to work for them, and they expect the resources out there to work for them, not the other way around. So as you can see, it was a combination of things happening all at once that really led us more and more in the direction of open access, which, even though it exists on the commercial side, and that's certainly a whole separate conversation, but it's really closely associated with, and for a good reason, with academic publishing. And let's not forget that it was the scholars, the professors out there, the scholars, the researchers who began, even though today it's really about publishers and libraries and how they work together and make this possible. It was really those from the inside, scholarly circles and academia, that began the movement.
And just on that, it occurred to me when I first came into publishing that the economics of this industry were quite extraordinary, to put it mildly, in that authors were not being paid, they're now being charged. Institutions are sort of funding research, but also buying it back through subscriptions. So it's quite a unique model in terms of that. I understand the impetus from authors and researchers to kind of adopt a new model. But when OA was first formulated as a concept, are you aware of any kind of foundational commercial models that were proposed around it? Because when I look at it now, you know, several years on, there's a kind of multitude of approaches towards it, which I'd love to talk about with you. Do you know if there was a sort of founding principle?
Well, the principle was free access. So it's always been about free access, less about... but it became very quickly about who pays, because somebody has to pay for the production of the content, for the release of the content. Publishers are absolutely essential to the process of scholarly communications. Without them, we lose that layer of evaluation and scrutiny. And then, of course, there's peer review, which we need for a different reason. But here I'm talking about editors and an army of professionals. So the question became early on, how do we pay for this? How do we cover the cost of this? And somewhere along the way, well, I mean, the first two open access models that sort of became, first it was the green open access and then the gold open access. There are many different kinds of open access. But it all started with green open access, which meant researchers will, after they publish their work, if they choose so to publish it open access, such as their theses, or to upload it into their institution's repository, available freely online. It's what I did with my dissertation, for example, what everybody does these days. But then gold open access really entered the picture to allow scholars to publish their work more professionally. And that meant... That was the beginning of the introduction of APCs and BPCs. APCs for article processing charges for journals and book processing charges for books. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people agreed to that. A lot of scholars covered the cost of publishing their own work because they wanted their work to be accessed widely, and they wanted more citations for their work. From very early on, we knew as an industry, we kept track of this, that the more open the work was, the more citations it would get, the more impact, the higher its impact. So researchers saw a lot of value in that. But then with time, that became a challenge. And finally, the industry took that very seriously. Why should the researchers pay? It makes no sense. Why should the author pay for publishing their work, for the privilege of having this work be published and made freely available? They certainly don't make any money afterwards, because there's no money from sales once a book or journal become open access, or certainly when once a book is published open access, it's open access in perpetuity. That's when the model that I hope we spend more time talking about today entered the picture, the diamond open access, which was the answer to the gold open access, which tried through different venues. And that's when all these different models began to proliferate. Not so easy to keep up with them anymore because there's so many. But the idea being, why don't we ask institutions to cover the cost of publishing? Why not place the burden on the funders, the institutions, the academia, and not those who actually do the research and write. And that way, the publishers can still publish open access professionally, and the books would still be, or journals would still be published open access. So in recent years, certainly in the last decade, if not more, it's really become about that. And I, for one, got even more excited about open access once Diamond Open Access began to make more of an impact, because I never liked gold open access. I had lots of problems with it. I just never could wrap my mind around a researcher having to pay for publishing their own article. I remember when I published my first article years ago with a publisher, I attended a conference, so they told me it was going to be published as a Diamond Open Access, no fee involved. But because it wasn't a gold access publisher, the email I got was from this automated email that automatically charges you once you submit your paper.
Right.
And I remember getting that email and just imagine being a researcher and getting that kind of an email where you have to take out your credit card and pay. Yeah. We're talking 3, 4, 5,000 euros or dollars per article. So we are at a point now, we are at a crossroads, I believe, where the industry is now, when I say the industry, I mean everybody, every player in the ecosystem, publishers, the organizations in the middle, funders, libraries, everybody really is more or less on board that it's about shifting the burden, the financial burden, to institutions, funding more and more works to be published open access in that way. Supporting different types of open access, because open access really began with journals. You asked me how the story began, definitely with journals. It took a while for monographs, scholarly books, to catch on. This was the topic of my own research. But eventually they did, following pretty much the same trajectory, the same narrative, the gold open access and, you know, moving on to Diamond. And now Diamond, when we speak of Diamond, of course, there are different models, both for books and journals. But the unifying goal is to help researchers get published without having to pay for it.
I'm keen to speak about Diamond in some detail, but I guess just if I think of OA and some of the challenges on a macro level that we have, things I've seen in recent years. You mentioned the desire to publish, and that the industry is built on a kind of publish or perish mantra. And I wonder if you think OA has had an impact in that, from a negative point of view or from a positive point of view. How do you see those two things in balance?
That's a really loaded question. It's a layered question, because I'm thinking how to answer it by including everything that's part of that larger picture, including how easy and difficult it is to publish open access, how rigorous the peer review process is for open access versus closed access. What the preferences have become, because we do see preferences that, whether we like to admit them or not, and priorities that we've sort of set in motion. So I think every single player, including the scholars, the scholarly community, has played their part in getting us to this place that is incredibly complex and in dire need of simplification and what I like to call shared responsibility.
Well, I was going to ask if you could outline what you see as because I understand my question is there's a multitude of answers to the question I asked, but I'm wondering perhaps if you can outline yourself what you see as the unintended consequences of OA and the model.
Unintended consequences, sure. So for example, let's look at the three groups individually. So if we look at scholars, one of the challenges with on their end is, sounds good, I like that my work is out there reaching scholars in remote parts of the world where I never thought that my research would be looked at and built upon. But I can't risk my reputation by publishing with just anyone. I have a long-standing relationship with a very traditional publisher, respected by libraries. So I will let others experiment and I will stick with that. So I use it as an example to show how the scholarly community stifled sometimes this process by being very careful whether they want to publish open access because of the many players in the industry. Their variable or varied reputations, because there's another thing. There's something called black open access, which I touched on. I guess you can say that piracy is black open access, but all these so-called vanity publishers also were brought into this ecosystem with emerging technologies, which allowed a lot of publishers who are not traditional publishers, organizations who don't have editorial practices as the backbone of their business, to massively produce large amounts of content and get paid for it. And so many scholars took that stand that they would not risk it with them, whereas for others, it became more about getting published because their article getting accepted by a reputable journal sometimes was not so easy. And they, especially if we take into account that a lot of journals prefer certain types of researchers from certain regions and affiliated with certain institutions, there are certain inequalities that we've been aware of for a while now. So that shows you how some researchers would be more open to that type of publishing versus others. And that's created this uneven landscape in terms of the types of content being produced and who produces it. On the library end, here we're talking about institutions that for as long as they've existed, it's been their job to be the gatekeepers of information, to purchase, to share with their communities. But then it got complicated. Then all of a sudden, it wasn't just about purchasing, it was about subscriptions. And then once open access entered the pictures, it became also about funding, right? So if they get this funding that they are allowed, this government money that they are required, not allowed, but required to spend on open access, they become decision makers in a very specific way. They have to decide what did they fund to make their money really count, to please everyone who's counting on them to make the most of the money that they have available. So libraries have not always been so quick to jump on the bandwagon. Sometimes they would embrace new initiatives and allocate funding to support certain models. And sometimes they would step back and say, no, not this, not this time. But what's become clear over time is that they would still have to keep up with their subscriptions. Because with open access, it's not like it's not two buttons. It's not a switch on and off. Like they still have to maintain their subscriptions while slowly allocating a certain percentage of their funding for open access. And now it also depends on the size. Even in the UK, for example, you have different institutions handling open access differently. Some larger institutions literally have open access teams in place who get their funding specifically to be used for open access. So they only work with open access content and open access collections. And then you have in other smaller institutions, you often have librarians who are also subject librarians who receive a certain amount of funding, which they have to allocate between different sources, not just subscriptions, but also open access and everything else. And then publishers, they especially have to protect their bottom line because they need to always make sure the revenue comes from somewhere, because they can only publish open access if they get the funding from libraries. So while they are experimenting with open access models, they too will continue publishing through traditional channels until they figure out what model works best for them. And so to wrap this up, that's how we got to this point where we have a multitude of open access models existing in parallel with traditional publishing models.
And I suppose if you're thinking about that, that commercial equation, the other part that I'm sure you're very well aware of is the funding bodies themselves. It's not just libraries who are funding, making allocations. There's institutions, private institutions, public kind of allocating funds towards this. Does that sort of Does that introduce a level of bias into the setup?
It introduces another layer of complexity. I always think of it in terms of libraries because I've worked with them the most, but I'm very well aware that the funding can come from different sources, not necessarily from university libraries, but they have traditionally been the ones to support their researchers, and because they are the ones who work with faculty and these authors, and they're trying to carry this financial burden for them. There is a synergy there that exists. But I don't think that there's bias. I just think that there are different types of requirements and expectations.
I suppose what I see in lots of conferences that I attend is that everybody, I say that with a caveat, seems to be in support of what open access is trying to achieve. I've listened to Mandy Hill a couple of years ago at a Redux conference with ALPS, where she talked about the challenges of open access from an economic sustainability point of view, but said they're very committed to the project. And again, I think that's sort of commendable from this industry, that something that is so economically challenging and potentially disruptive has still been embraced by everybody, that sort of for the greater good. And I think with all the complexity you've mentioned, there still seems to be that drive that people believe in this project.
Well, yeah, you asked me very early on what motivated me to get excited about open access. I try not to say it anymore at the risk of sounding, as my daughter and son would say, cringe. But that really was the main reason. How could it not be? The greater good. It just feels good to be involved with something that is transforming the world and making it just a little bit better, you know? It's a wonderful cause, and it's complex, but it's not impossible. And you know, you reach a point in your career where you simply want more purpose. And I think that I speak for many when I say that. You know, you want your job to count. You want what you do to matter. You want to leave your little mark in whatever way you can. And I think we all do in our different ways. And that's all you can hope for. And I'm speaking for books and journals here, for publishing. How that works out for movies and other creative industries is time will tell. But I think that we have this wonderful opportunity. Well, we simply have to. That's the other thing, right? Can't afford not to. It's not even a question of, you said that, you know, publishers are happy to embrace it. Yes, but they also have no choice. And I will go on the record here and say, if they think they do, they are mistaken, or at least, at the very least, not looking far into the future. And the future is here already, if you just think about AI and what it does already and what it will do years from now. So it's simply a necessity. I don't think that, and I work with many different publishers over the years. I cannot think of a single publisher at the moment who doesn't have an open access strategy in place. Many of them, their own original models that they came up with. Some of them joining forces with others. Some of them relying on organizations that merge different publishing content together. But they are part of the narrative. Everybody is. University presses, small publishers, independent publishers, large corporations, open access born, open access only publishers, you name it. Everyone, and then even like, you know, libraries becoming publishers, university libraries as publishers, that's also like sort of become something that we talk about more these days. But it's really a matter of not just saying I support it in principle. I used to hear that a lot. It's not something, I don't like that phrase, I support something in principle. It bothers me. It means you're not really going to do anything about it. But in practice, let's support it in practice fully, and let's not be afraid to make more mistakes.
As you know, we conduct a survey every year asking publishers questions around their strategy and operations. And I suppose 3 years ago, looking back at those reports, OA was a massive topic in these surveys. It was consistently a kind of an agenda item in boardrooms that was causing challenges with the kind of economics for the operations. It's a real balance between getting sort of, you know, believing in supporting the kind of ethical position of OA and the workflow pressures and the economics of it. I suppose in recent years, with AI coming into the picture, that seems to settle down. Like this year, OA was still a concern, but it was sort of in the top five rather than the top two. And I'm wondering whether you feel like it's settling down as a model, and publishers are now sort of resolved that it's there. They understand the economics of it, and it'll kind of form its own basis in the future. Do you see any kind of major shifts coming?
Well, I've been thinking about this a lot since leaving KU about 6 or 7 months ago.
KU, just we should say, is Knowledge Unlatched, yes?
So I've been thinking about this a lot since leaving Knowledge Unlatched about 6 or 7 months ago. But it was really during my time at Knowledge Unlatched that this became very obvious to me. So while I'm very proud of the work I did at Knowledge Unlatched, it was also the place that allowed me to see the holes, the gaps, what was missing, and how that would impact AI. And so when I decided to leave Knowledge Unlatched, I really wanted to spend a good amount of time to step back from the industry that I was part of since my very early 20s. And for the first time in my professional career, really ask myself some tough questions, but also ask myself some honest questions about what I've learned along the way. And that's where it became more and more obvious that there have been, as an industry, as a whole, we've created these gaps that AI will inherit if we do not improve them. And I thought about them, and I realized that I have something meaningful to say. Whether my colleagues out there are thinking along the same lines, I don't know yet. I hope they are. I would love to have this conversation with them, but I'm also happy to share with you where I see us going and what I think is necessary for us as an industry to make sure that... You see, I don't think that AI is going to end publishing in any way. Not at all. I think of AI as a wonderful opportunity for publishers, particularly for open access publishing. The story that should interest us is, okay, so who's feeding this information? And I took the time to really understand in recent months where this knowledge comes from, how it's created, how it's fed into AI systems, how AI uses it, and what the future holds. And it became very clear to me that AI simply needs, it depends heavily on open access content to thrive into the future. I am well aware that publishers are licensing their behind closed content, behind paywall content used in the training of AI, because as you know, probably know, AI does not crawl resources live. Certainly that's my understanding.
So my understanding, we discussed this at the New York Roundtable, is that these models get retrained from time to time, but there's no... They literally have to go back to scratch and retrain them. And it's an extensive piece of work and costly piece of work, which is why it only happens from time to time.
Yeah. And also, the reason why these training sessions don't, common sense, the reason they don't happen so often is because they have to clear all the contracts and licenses with all these different publishers. Open access, on the other hand, will not require, already does not require, licensing agreements of any kind. Once you publish a book, let's stick with books for now, because it's a little bit more complex on the journal side. So when a book is published open access, a book is assigned one of several Creative Commons licenses. An AI organization or those in charge within the organization will know specifically very well what they can and cannot do with that content. So it just, for a lot of reasons that, just for the sake of time here, I will not go into them, but there are a lot of reasons why the future of AI relies on more and more open access content, scholarly content being published open access, so that AI sources can continually tap into them and use that information to spread this knowledge as fast as possible. Now, let me step back here and say, but what do you mean? You mentioned some things that AI will inherit that are not so great that we need to pay attention to. Well, this is exactly the part that I hope my colleagues, both in publishing and libraries, at least agree with to some extent. We need to ask ourselves, if that's the case, if AI is already using thousands of open access books and other sources, have we been publishing the best content out there, the most reliable, the most relevant, the most up-to-date? Have we done everything we can in this process of from nominating a book to be published open access, getting the funding, seeing it through, actually delivering it? That process is deeply flawed. That process is deeply flawed at various steps, not just one. And I lived in that space for the last 6 or 7 years. And that is not, that's a very specific kind of position that many of us don't occupy. And I sort of landed in it by chance. And it took me leaving Knowledge Unlatched to really understand that it was a blessing in disguise, because it really helped me see there is a layer missing that I hope we can embrace in the future And that includes really working closely with both sides to deliver the most relevant content that will be ingested into AI down the line. Librarians often complaining that publishers do not save the best content to be published open access, but the marginal content. Because I worked with librarians, I really understood the complaints because it was a huge part of my job to talk to them daily and to try to convince them to allocate funding for various open access collections. And so when they tell you things like, but this collection does not include relevant titles. And the more I talk to librarians, the more I realize that they're really questioning the content.
Yeah.
Is this what we want? You are producing this in a haste. Who is checking this? And after we give you the money, we don't know what happens. You know, what happens is after we get the money and the publishers get the money, we move on to the next collection and the next round of funding. So I built something. I'm actually sharing this with you publicly for the first time. I built something that I'd like to call the structural layer that is missing that I would like to introduce, called meditorial insight or meditorial work. It's not editorial because we don't want to mess with what publishers do. They do that extremely well. It is not anything that librarians alone do. It's what those of us in the middle need to do. We need editorial, like zoomed out, if you will, on top of editorial. The type of evaluation that has long been missing. And as the only editor standing in a room full of people whose backgrounds are IT and business and information technology, eventually I realized as the editor among them that it really bothered me that we did not spend more time evaluating the relevance of the content. Oftentimes, libraries do not know how many titles will be published with the funding they set aside. This needs to be upfront. What is going to be the BPC per title in a collection? Will it be $8,550? Will it be $9,000? Will it be $10,000? Whatever is needed, libraries need that transparency. It works both ways, but this isn't about holding anyone accountable specifically. It's really about shared responsibility. What is it that library... Let's phrase it in the simplest terms I can think of fast right now. Meditorial asks or helps libraries decide what should be funded, what needs funding. So the more we do that meditorial work, that layer that's missing, the more attention we pay in the middle instead of just being focused on getting the book out, getting the money to publish it open access, we spend some time in the middle to truly make it count, because this content then is fed into the AI systems. There is a second layer of meditorial, so the first one that I just talked about, there's a lot, many more steps there that I call the meditorial imprint. That is the imprint we create, right? The imprint pre-funding, during funding, and after funding. Meditorial footprint, that's what happens post-AI. Because the more we work on the imprint, the better off we are, the stronger the footprint of these books and resources. So we have, as I see it, this shared responsibility as an industry to recognize this missing layer. There may be more. This is the one that I am most interested in because it's the space I occupied. So that the AI systems out there can be fed the best possible information they can in the fastest possible, as fast as possible, as accurately as possible, and reliably and continuously. I see it as a powerful position for all of us.
Yeah, you know, I, I'm I applaud your thinking, and I wish you'd been in our New York round table, because we had a good debate about this very topic. And it stemmed from a conversation in a room about the training of LLMs and how infrequently they are retrained. I think it was a surprise to many people in the room that there was no sort of live retraining, continuous live training, or indeed curation of LLMs and the content that we're submitted to. So someone in the room used a very a somewhat crass but illustrative example, that in lots of the LLMs that we're currently using now, that there's flat earth theory still in there. No one's taken that theory out. There's no recency bias in these LLMs. There's a lot of, to your point, there's a lot of bad science in the LLMs that people are accessing. I suppose how I see it is that we haven't really been invited to be that editor, that curator, before these AI models were built. They were built largely without our knowledge. We sort of found out about them afterwards and got lawyers involved to then compensate us.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose what you're talking about now is retrospectively getting involved and somehow perfecting it in the future. And as you say, being that filter between the commercial guys and the IT people out there who are building these models.
Well, when I say the IT community, well, see, I meant more in terms of not just retrospectively. I'm looking into the future here. I am proposing that moving forward, we take greater care in what we publish open access. Because once open access is out there, it is the very first thing that AI can ingest, the easiest content AI can ingest. We need to make sure that whatever money is poured into open access counts. Because that's going to be the content that AI grabs first and fast. We need to make sure that the allocated funds for open access really do support coherent collections that tackle relevant topics, cutting-edge topics that align with what scholars need, particularly at the institutions that are willing to support. You see, all of this requires a lot of work, a lot of monitoring and tracking. So I hope that answers your question. It's really about making funding count.
And Mirella, whose role would that be in future? Because, you know, if you think about, we've spoken a lot, and I speak about it often, about the role of publishers in an age of AI, how that might change. Are you talking about publishers adopting departments to kind of manage this function? Is this something that needs to be a function within tech giants who are building LLMs? Who's going to be responsible for this new layer?
They can. I think it can work in many different ways. I think you already have publishers with their own open access strategies, quite a few of them. So if that's something that they want to do, since their collections only include their books, it makes sense that maybe they would create their own, or, you know, either departments or expanded roles of certain individuals. But it's not just about staying close to the content. It's really about monitoring and tracking a wide range of activities across the spectrum on that journey from acquiring a book or journal to seeing it published, open access.
There's a lot of talk about Google Zero coming along. This kind of phenomenon that what Steve Smith and others have called disintermediation of publishing, that essentially AI and the sort of tech giants are becoming the face of knowledge, and that the kind of searches that we're conducting on the internet, answers are being provided to us by LLMs, by Google, using their own LLMs and their own database. And that for increasingly, people aren't clicking through to go to the source material. So therefore, that the ultimate threat of that is that publishers' websites won't be visited as often, full articles won't be read. Information will be provided to people kind of at the point of need to the extent to which they want it to be fed to them, whether in a kind of soundbite or a kind of a report or whatever it might be. This idea of source material being fed to these LLMs, but it then having the power to provide that in a format that suits that end user. That to me always seems a bit of an existential risk to publishers, because if that starts to happen, then publishers function as a packager of knowledge, you know, putting it into a fixed format, creating a book, creating an article, giving it a brand, suddenly seems less important, because ultimately nobody's buying it through that brand. Everybody's going to, you know, one or two LLMs to kind of get that. Does this aspect, this metatory you're talking about, does that give publishers a role in that future, in that the job of publishers becomes curators? It becomes, it ensures that those LLMs are trusted and that they have been overseen by editors and others who have the kind of greater good at heart. Is that, am I right in kind of bringing those two themes together, you think?
Yes. But let me just take a step back here and say something that, well, I've certainly witnessed this firsthand in my own career. So to be fair and to be frank, publishers started giving more power to the IT side of things within our own industry long before AI entered the picture. And I think especially in open access, we allowed this to happen. In open access, more than any other branch of publishing, we allowed the non-editorial voice, the non-creator voice, to be the loudest in the room. Because we were so afraid that if we don't keep up with the technology, that we will simply become less relevant. And yet what's happened in this age of too much information, too much of everything, in the end, quality will be key. The most important question, and this is the greater good part, is that it's accurate. Mm-hmm. It's that it's accurate. And that is not something that AI can do without us. This is why I separated meritorial into imprint and footprint, because as you probably know, AI organizations already have people in place who help them decide what to ingest, usually made up of librarian, IT professionals, a wide variety of professions. But that's after the fact. That's when something's already been out there, done, polished, published. They are not interested in what's inside. They are not interested in how relevant this content is. They look at the reputation of the publisher. There is a whole list of things that they look at, and that's fine. But we need the meritorial imprint to be able to influence this footprint that it leaves behind, because it is all about reuse. Again, going back to the very beginning of our conversation, the promise of open access publishing is it's the free availability of the content, which can not only be accessed, but reused. Used and reused, shared and reshared. And so that's where I see publishers continuing to be the main and really the only authority. And it's going to take all of us. And I think that there is enough, certainly enough room for everybody and then some. So again, I don't think that we are sort of being integrated into this whole AI story and somehow becoming diminished or small. It's simply not true, because that path would lead to something pretty catastrophic.
I'm enjoying your thinking. I think it's an interesting approach for sure. And I suppose it crystallizes some of the conversations I've had with others. You've started to put a framework around, which I think is really interesting. I suppose I'm always thinking practicalities. How does this happen? What does it mean? What does it look like in reality? But that's for future thinking. I understand the principle. I suppose also my fear is always that money leads. You know, look at OA, just despite the sort of the founding principles of OA, it's become an economic issue for many people. And that's what's kind of driving the market in lots of ways. So I suppose what you're thinking comes from a sort of place of good, but they would have to sort of serve the market in many ways. How yes. Are you going to go about this? What's your starting point?
I think as an industry, certainly on the open access side, we've been retelling the same story for quite a while now. And I said to you, Patrick, if you remember when we first met, I stopped going to conferences for a while just because I keep hearing the same thing over and over again. So maybe if I step back, maybe it'll all sound new. Let's not retell the same story over and over again. I would love for us and for me personally to start that next chapter where, you know, we introduce new concepts and you know, really take ownership of the content. Because that's who we are. This is what done forever.
Well, Mirella, I think it's a wonderful initiative and I wish you well with it. I think as you say, a lot of conferences that we go to, a lot of these conversations, they're all about repeating the challenges. And I'll include myself in that. We often repeat challenges. You've come up with a potential solution, which I think is wonderful. And I certainly wish you luck with it. And thank you so much for being our guest today.
Yeah. One of solutions, many solutions needed.
One of many, but I agree. We've all got a role to play in that. And I can see it working for sure. But thank you so much for being a guest today. I really appreciate your time. And please come back and talk to us again once this initiative is underway and tell us how it's going.
I'd love to. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to me, Patrick Schaaf, and my guest, Mirella Roncevic. This is the Trends in Academic Publishing podcast brought to you by Dainta, Next Level Publishing Solutions. If you're interested in what's happening in the industry, you can get a free copy of Dainta's annual survey, also called Trends in Academic Publishing, from our website. There's a link in the show notes below.